Thanks a lot.
WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Coming up next, Code Pink.
Bush and Bin Laden, you think they're foes? They're in business together. Daddy Bush knows the Carlyle Group since years before been raking in billions and itching for more.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link.
They say code war,
we say code pink.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link. They say code war,
we say code pink.
Code pink for freedom, code pink for peace, code pink to hunger.
And that was Code Pink by Emma's Revolution. Hello, everyone, and good afternoon from right here in New York City. My name is Rose Asaf, and I use she, her pronouns. And this is Code Pink Radio. We're coming live on WBAI Radio 99.5 in New York City and WPFW 89.3 Washington, D.C. And today's a special day because I'm not by myself. I'm joined by Code Pink co-founder, international activist and artist Jody Evans. Hi, Jody. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Hey, Rose. It's so great to be here with you at WBAI in New York City.
Yes, so happy to have you today. And for those of you who are not familiar with us, Code Pink is a women's-led anti-war group that is organizing across the country to put an end to U.S.-funded militarism around the world. We are here to challenge imperialism, rogue capitalism, and war, and create a world of justice, peace, and equality. That might sound like a big task, and the truth is that it is. Achieving justice requires each and every one of us to join together in solidarity and demand a better world. And if you're listening to this show, you're already on the right path. Today's show is a special one. Not only are we joined by Jody here in New York City, we are also going to be bringing on two guests whom you're going to want to listen to. First, we are talking to Yifat Suskind, the executive director of MADRE, an international human rights organization that partners with community-based women's groups worldwide facing war and disaster. After that, we will be joined by Daniel Ellsberg. Some of you might know him as the whistleblower that leaked the Pentagon Papers that exposed the U.S. government's campaign of lies about its activities in Vietnam. So he's going to be here in the second part of the hour, so please stay tuned for that. But before we get ahead of ourselves, let's take a moment to talk about the news. Hurricane Dorian is still heading toward the continental U.S. and nearing the Carolinas as we speak. The storm has already devastated the Bahamas, where over 20 people have been killed by this climate crisis. Much of the islands are still underwater, and debris and ruins are scattered throughout the streets of the island. While Dorian is now down to a Category 3 hurricane, there is worry that it will make landfall on the U.S. coast. Conditions of the storm have already caused tornadoes across the Carolinas and flooding in Charleston. 200,000 people in the Carolinas are now without power, and projections show that matters don't seem to be letting up anytime soon. And on the topic of the climate crisis, last night CNN hosted a six-hour special climate town hall with the top presidential candidates. Almost all of the candidates have released some form of a climate plan to this point, but what remains to be seen is what will become of them. The Green New Deal has dominated headlines for quite some time, and now we need the political will to actually get there. But with a Republican-controlled Senate and White House, we need to continue to keep the pressure up and demand that our elected officials be accountable to the people instead of fossil fuel executives who line their pockets with a scorched earth. We cannot forget that tackling this climate crisis is also impossible without also tackling U.S. militarism. After all, the U.S. military is the world's largest polluter. But still, this is a global issue. As we sit here today, the Amazon rainforest, which is the lungs of the world and home to over 1 million indigenous people, is still on fire. Various indigenous communities living in the Amazon have joined forces against Jair Bolsonaro's assault on indigenous communities and the environment. Mudhire Kayapo, one of the indigenous leaders in the Amazon, said, "Today we only have one enemy, which is the Brazilian government, the president of Brazil, and the invasions of non-indigenous people." Last Sunday, the Trump-backed Saudi coalition killed over 100 people in a bombing of a Yemeni prison. The attack is being described as one of the deadliest on Yemen this year. The airstrike comes after Trump vetoed the War Powers Resolution that could have ended U.S. military cooperation with Saudi Arabia and would have helped to bring about an end to the devastation and warfare in Yemen. It's time to sever ties with Saudi Arabia. No engagement with Saudi Arabia until they end their war and assault on Yemen. And there are two things that you can do today. Have you heard of Lush Cosmetics? Yes, that Lush Cosmetics, the one that is socially responsible, actually has two stores in Saudi Arabia. We at Code Pink have been calling on them to close those stores, and you can join us in this campaign by going to your local Lush and communicating this message. We're also calling on Vice Media to stop doing PR for the Saudi regime through its partnership with the Saudi Research and Marketing Group, an arm of the Saudi monarchy. We all need to be doing everything we can. The truth is that Yemen can't wait. Relations between Israel and Hezbollah have become more tense in the past week. Hezbollah is an Islamist political party and an armed group in Lebanon that has frequently clashed with Israel throughout the years. Over the weekend, Hezbollah, in a stated retaliation to an Israeli drone strike, launched rockets into Israel from the southern border of Lebanon. Lebanon PM Hariri distanced himself from the attacks, stating, "Israel wants to have this scenario that Lebanon is responsible. The international community knows that this is not true." For now, it seems that both sides want to avoid an all-out war. The last time this happened was in 2006, when far over 1,000 civilians were killed, 1,200 of whom were Lebanese and 45 of whom were Israeli. And before moving to the local news, I just want to note that India's occupation and crackdown on Kashmir continues. There are thousands of reports of torture, detention, beatings, and more. You can go to standwithkashmir.org to learn more about the crisis in Kashmir. Turning to the states, just this week, the Cherokee Nation named its first official congressional delegate, which was promised to the nation in a 200-year-old treaty with the federal government. Kimberly Teehee, the executive director of the government relations for the Cherokee Nation, is set to take this place. And also this week, the woman who formerly we knew as Emily Doe from the Brock Turner case revealed her identity. Her name is Chanel Miller. In 2016, Chanel's story made headlines when she accused Brock Turner of sexually assaulting her when she was unconscious at a party in 2015. Turner got a slap on the wrist, and this is no surprise because he was a former student athlete at Stanford University and was white, wealthy, and connected. He was sentenced to 6 months in county jail, and he only served 3 of those months. Now Chanel Miller is telling her story. On September 24th, her memoir, Know My Name, will be released. And last but not least, here in New York City, the abolitionist advocacy group No New Jails has been advocating against Mayor de Blasio's jail expansion plan, which would give the city the okay to spend $10 billion on 4 new jails under flimsy pretenses that Rikers Island will one day be closed. But let us be clear, this plan will in no way ensure the closing of Rikers. Instead, it will do what it's stated to do. Build 4 new jails. And 4 new jails means 4,600 new jail cells. And let's call these cells what they really are, cages. And I feel compelled to remind you all that human rights violations are regularly committed in New York City jails. And improving the construction of 4 new jails would give license for these abuses to continue. On Tuesday, the City Planning Commission voted yes on Mayor Bill de Blasio's plan, with 9 people voting yes, 3 voting no, and 1 abstention. I was there that day and joined No New Jails and urging the commission members to vote no on the plan. But now it moves forth to the city council. Later today, I will be joining No New Jails again for a city council hearing on the issue. Instead of investing $10 billion in 4 new jails, a sum akin to the funding needed for Trump's border wall, let's instead invest in our communities, our schools, in NYCHA, health services, and so on. If this is something you want to get involved with, you can go to nonewjails.nyc. Again, this is Code Pink Radio with Rose, WBAI 99.5 FM, WPFW 89.3 Washington, D.C.
Thanks, Rose. So I want to bring on Ifat. Ifat, are you
with? Hi, Jody. Hi, Rose.
Good morning. Welcome. We're thrilled to have you on with us this morning. So for those of you who don't know Yifat Susskind, she's the executive director of MADRE. Yifat works to make human rights a reality for all people. For more than 20 years, she's partnered with women's human rights activists from Latin America, the Middle East, Asia, and Africa to create programs in their communities that combine grassroots partnerships and international advocacy to meet urgent needs and create lasting solutions. Yifat, why don't we start by you introducing the work of MADRE to those listening?
Yeah, great. So MADRE is based in New York City, but we work all around the world in solidarity with very grassroots women's organizations that are really folks on the front lines of war and climate breakdown. And what we're doing with our partners is working with them to meet really urgent needs in their communities and create long-term social change. In a way, what our partner organizations are doing is really what women are doing every place in communities, which is caring for the most vulnerable, meeting really basic needs, and trying to realize people's dreams of social justice. And at MADRE, that work is done through a combination of grant making to get resources into the hands of feminist community organizers in some of the world's toughest places. It's a model of grant making that really isn't about charity, but about recognizing that our basic survival is bound up with the survival of folks all around the world. And really, we see that kind of philanthropy as a way of redistributing wealth, because we're here in New York City where there is a lot of wealth. And in addition to making sure that people have the resources to provide food and clean water and health care and often shelter from violence, especially for women and LGBT folks, we're working with our partners to enable them to change the kinds of laws and policies that you've been speaking about and that generate human rights violations and really hold women and girls back and LGBT people back from living lives that, you know, we all deserve to live. So just was talking with the group that we work with in Iraq, the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, and they are just working on a pending draft law, the first ever domestic violence law in Iraq to criminalize marital rape, for example. And, I think what is so amazing about women's organizing in these really hard places, the places that we read about and just feel like unimaginable to live in, places really devastated by war and by climate breakdown, is that people are, on one hand, living through like the worst conditions we can imagine, but they're so focused on the future and on building something better for themselves and their kids. And I want to just give like a little bit of a sense of like some of the amazing organizing that's happening in places that we hardly ever get to hear about because of how the media works and distance and the stories that we're so accustomed to hearing. A coworker of mine just came back from visiting our partner group in Guatemala and Nicaragua, doing an exchange of indigenous women from the highlands of Guatemala, the place that was really the epicenter of the U.S.-backed genocide back in the 1980s, and enabling groups of elder women and young girls and midwives and activists from indigenous groups in Guatemala to visit the autonomous indigenous territory in Nicaragua. And people are really concretely figuring out what it looks like to make their communities safe and sustainable, in both to heal from the genocide in Guatemala, the Contra War, also backed by the U.S. back in the 1980s in Nicaragua, and not just to sort of recover from past abuses, but also to build a future where their communities are sustainable and healthy and vibrant so that migration is like truly a choice for people.
So an example of where the funds should be spent instead of building a wall, building peace in the communities that we've devastated. This is amazing. Can you maybe tell us, like, what does that look like on the ground?
Yeah, I mean, it looks like, well, I'll tell you what it doesn't look like. It doesn't look like foreign aid from one imperialist government to another corrupt government, right, where elites are kind of exchanging resources among themselves and making all the decisions. it really looks like, and this is where, you know, all of us have a role to play, it really looks like finding ways to support people in communities who are creating their own solutions and doing that work for themselves, including the work of holding governments accountable so that, you know, national budgets are structured the way that we need them to be structured. Our partners in Guatemala and Nicaragua are doing a combination of, you know, of creating food sovereignty programs, changing food systems so that people can grow their own food and grow the food that they want to be eating, not be reliant on imported processed food that is from outside their culture and leads to sort of the erosion of their own cultures. It's also about climate change adaptation, you know, realizing that the ways that people have relied on getting food before aren't sustainable in this time of protracted drought, and figuring out real solutions. So, for example, women getting together to learn what it looks like to have small-scale chicken farming, where they can raise eggs that are about sustaining the nutrition of their own families, selling eggs in the market so they can generate income to pay school fees so that their kids can go to school and have basic health care. A lot of this is small scale. And, you know, sometimes when we think about, like, these massive global problems like climate change, we sort of imagine that these big problems require really big solutions. But the truth is that that's part of the thinking that got us into this problem in the first place. And I think what we're seeing is that local democratically controlled changes that can be scaled up not by making them massive, but by replicating them far and wide and institutionalizing what does work for people is really a better choice. And Madre's partners are on the front line of a lot of that work.
So basically, and that's the building blocks for peace that we're not hearing about anywhere. And so what you're doing is actually nourishing and building these blocks of peace. And you're so right about when we talk about big problems, we think it's going to be a big solution instead of realizing the big was the problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it makes sense. You know, we should be thinking about things like, you know, climate negotiations really as peace negotiations, because really what laying the groundwork for sustainable environmental policies does is to prevent future conflicts. And that's, I think, important to make that connection.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Go
ahead.
I want to share a little bit about some work in the Middle East that I think people, you know, just we don't hear enough about, which, again, is the work that local women's organizations are doing in the war-torn parts of Yemen and Syria. And, you know, I think our listeners know that there's an amazing amount of you know, sort of courage and steadfastness among people who are living through that, but we don't often hear about the ways in which women's organizations are doing work that the international community really has totally failed to do. And I'm talking about, in the context of both Syria and Yemen, work like, you know, setting up humanitarian aid corridors and brokering local ceasefires and negotiating prisoner exchanges and, you know, evacuating armed groups from taking over schools and community centers. You know, this is work that really is should be part of the mission of the United Nations, isn't work that the international community is supporting or succeeding at. And yet it's these grassroots women's organizations that get so little, really almost no funding from the international community, that are the front line of defense for communities in these war-torn areas.
Wow, that's amazing. Thank you. So, you know, you've been doing this work for 20 years. What's inspiring you right now, and are there ways that you're thinking differently about your work, given where we are in time?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of us, and I'm sure this is true for a lot of our listeners, right, are having this kind of paradoxical experience of the political moment that we're in, right, where it sort of feels like worst of times, best of times. And what I mean by that, I guess, is the way that the Trump administration has kind of, you know, upended and wholesale destroyed a lot of longstanding policy norms and sort of ways that people are used to the U.S. doing business in the world. And that destruction, you know, is destruction and is really dangerous for a lot of folks. And I think we need to do work to protect people who are most threatened by that. But it also, and this is the best of times part, right, has created these kind of unlikely strategic openings, including openings for much more progressive alternatives. And I think we're all, you know, seeing some of that in the outcome of the 2018, you know, the midterm elections, in the revitalization of so much social movement organizing here in the U.S. In a lot of ways, that same dynamic is happening around the world. And so it really is kind of our opportunity, but also our responsibility to kind of step into this space of possibility that's been opened up by, you know, by the crisis that we're in, and to demand the kind of changes that we need to see that don't just, you know, put us back to where we were in November 2016, but really put us on a path to creating a more just society. And I believe that that's possible and that it's actually happening.
Can you, is there an example that really inspires you right now?
Oh, there are so many examples. You know, I think that, you know, I just was opening an email from a Madre supporter, out in the Midwest, a young person in high school who sent me this email saying that, you know, it was her birthday and she decided that, like, she actually had enough stuff. Which is a realization that many more of us should come to, right? And so she was, for her birthday, asking folks to take up a collection for women that we're working with in Sudan and Kenya. And she's the child of Sudanese immigrants in Minnesota. And I just loved that because it was a reminder for me of something that really feels true right now, which is that, you know, we sometimes think of, like, activists as these, you know, kind of like unreachable heroes and feel like people who are doing this amazing work are, you know, somehow beyond us. Like, we couldn't possibly do that. When really the reality is that, like, we are all contributing to changing the world in all the many small decisions that we make all the time. And, you know, none of us have to do it all, luckily. We just have to do kind of our piece of the puzzle, right, and know how it connects to the piece next to ours. And I feel like, you know, resources like your show and alternative media and so much else that we now have at our disposal makes that a little bit easier. And that to me was just really inspiring, like just someone with a lot of humility but also a lot of inspiration being like, yeah, I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to make a contribution. And those contributions, you know, sometimes they're financial, sometimes they're our time. You know, we have like a global climate strike coming up later this month that's an opportunity for participation, and that's really like open to anybody and everybody. And we should step into those opportunities.
Yay, that's exactly what we need our listeners to hear. Thank you. Is there a woman that's inspiring you right now?
You know, I don't know if you all have seen Joy Harjo's new book, An American Sunrise, but I was reading it as my bedtime reading last night, and just thinking about, like, how inspirational she is, both as the first ever Indigenous U.S. Poet Laureate, but also as someone, and this is so much of what I was reading in American Sunrise, her new book, somebody who just is so artfully making these connections between the history of the United States and where we are now. And I think a lot of us have been sort of reflecting on our more recent history and the way that neoliberalism in the U.S. and around the world has kind of brought us to neo-fascism in a lot of ways. But Joy kind of takes it all the way back to the beginning in the ways that Indigenous peoples are such teachers in doing, and really makes the connection between the violence that we're seeing on our southern border and around the world and what has been foundational to the United States. But she's also able to do it in a way that really speaks to the alternatives and to the choices that we all have to decide who who we want to be as a country and who we want to be in our communities and what needs to happen for us to realize that. So if you haven't seen that book, I would check it out.
And that, again, is called An American Sunrise, right?
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. And Ifat, thank you so much for your words. I'm sitting right here in the studio feeling inspired by everything you said. So I tremendously appreciate you sharing this with our listeners. And I have some questions of my own, but I also want to give listeners a chance to call in and ask their own questions. So if you're listening from New York City or DC, you can call 212-209-2877. One more time, 212-209-2877. And until we get some listeners in, I just have a few questions of my own for Ifat. I'm just wondering more generally, how did you find yourself doing this work? Is this something that you've always been involved with, or was there something that specifically led you down this path that you're on right now?
I'm originally from Israel, and I spent a lot of time working in the Israeli women's peace movement and on a project way back in the 1990s for Palestinian political prisoners in Jerusalem. And that, you know, I think for a lot of us with the political work that we do in our 20s can become really, really formative, and that was certainly true for me. And I came to New York and the end of the 1990s and was fortunate enough to be mentored by Vivian Stromberg, who was a longtime executive director at MADRE, and really built that organization as a place was very put Palestinian solidarity work really front and center in what U.S. solidarity work needed to be with folks around the world, recognizing the sort of outsized role of the U.S. in the Israeli occupation and the violence that we've seen emanating from that and that still does. And so that MADRE became really a place for me to do my life's work, and it's something that I'm very grateful for.
That's amazing. And from somebody who comes from an Israeli family, I completely resonate with what you're saying and how we can integrate this work and deeper understanding of our own complicity with these systems into our work, which I think is extremely important.
I think it speaks to something that's true of all of us who are based here in the United States, which around the world is seen as the source of so much violence and destruction historically and now, and just a reminder that, you know, the identities that we're born with don't overdetermine who we are, right? Like, what determines who we are is what we do in this life and the what our beliefs are and how we act on them. And I think, you know, all of us are you know, holding identities that are part of oppressive systems, and many of us also holding identities that are oppressed. And that's not a contradiction. That's just real life. And we can learn from both parts of those identities, I think, and act on that politically.
Absolutely. And I think that's a beautiful reminder that regardless of where we're born or who we're born to, we get to decide what impact we have on this world. And that's nobody's decision to make, no country, no state, but our own. I just wanted to touch on one more thing that you brought up that I think was really significant to me, is this idea of international aid as we know it not being what we think it to be. It's more so, like you said, an exchange between one imperialist country to another. And I'm wondering if you can just speak a little more to that and kind of help break this idea of what I had and what a lot of listeners might have about what international aid as we know it is and where that actually goes, and better yet, where it should be going.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll give you a couple of concrete examples. You know, I just was talking to the partners that we're working with in Gaza, and Gaza is one of the places in the world where the devastation of the international aid system is, you know, kind of really horribly on display, because Israel and the U.S. have really concertedly destroyed the economy in Gaza, and in place, people have become reliant on international aid that that really kind of holds them hostage also politically, because the threat of that aid being withdrawn is life-threatening for people.
It's like international aid as a tool of warfare in its own perverse way.
Yeah. And it's true, you know, I think not just the political destruction and the way in which, you know, to render people dependent on international aid is really undermines, of course, people's agency, but also their capacity to build resilience and to be self-reliant in the face of crisis.
Absolutely.
It has also a lot of, like, really devastating environmental impact. So a few years ago, there was the threat of famine in northern Kenya on the Kenya-Somali border. And you know, Kenya is a little bit like California. It has all these microclimates. And so only like a hour and a half drive from the site of, you know, total drought and failed harvests and near famine, there were people harvesting all these beautiful fruits and vegetables. Mm-hmm. And yet driving just a short distance north, what you found was all of this, like, genetically engineered rice that had been grown in Texas and flown to Kenya to give to people as food aid.
Okay.
As opposed to creating the networks of solidarity where people right nearby can help their neighbors.
Absolutely.
When times are tough.
And
that's what we need to support.
I think we have a caller who is on the line. Hi, you are live on WBAI 99.5, WPFW 89.3. Thank you for calling in.
Hi, this is Bill from Belmont. Great show. I just wanted to comment and say, to see that women are going to be the ones to save mankind, as usual, I guess. Because I guess it's the cooperation that they have, and it seems that the males just have too much competition built into the society to cooperate for themselves and actually help each other. But are we getting to a point in mankind's history where we have to separate the wheat from the chaff, where, like, either you're for everybody and, you know, you're trying to help everybody, or you're going to keep this capitalist war, like, killing each other for, you know, another zero in their bank account, whatever we're doing. But it doesn't seem to be making any sense for the majority of the people. But the scared people on top of all the guns and everything else are really doing devastation to mankind. So, I mean, I think we have to make a stand and say, what is our future going to be? Is it going to be the same old past, where we blow the world up and then we have to rebuild it again, which is what basically we're doing in the Middle East? I don't get it, but I mean, I love that the women have to lead us, you know, like the mothers of mankind or whatever, and take action. You know, I don't know if it's the cooperation with the women. I just want to see what your thoughts are on that, and why men are so passively sitting alone on the side instead of coming together like the women do.
Ifat, do you want to take that one?
Sure. I mean, I guess, you know, my main response is that there's nothing biological about women's ability to cooperate and to act peacefully. You know, these are cultural traits that all of us need to learn. And I think that part of the hopefulness that we're seeing right now in the surge of feminist leadership of social movement organizing, not just, and I don't just mean in women's organizations, but in some of our most successful social movements, the Movement for Black Lives being an example, that both men and women have the option and the capacity to use a feminist analysis and to act in feminist ways. And that's what we need to develop more of in ourselves and our education so that it becomes the norm for the next generation. And I'll share a quote from a poet who was also part of the founding of Madre, a woman named Alexis DeVoe, who she has this poem where she says that motherhood is more than the organic process of giving birth. It's an understanding of the needs of the world. And I come back to that quote a lot as you know, being part of an organization called Madre, because I really do believe that that's what needs to happen. We need to reorient our thinking and our policies to care for the most vulnerable people in our communities and societies. And if we can do that, everything else will fall into place.
And I can't think of a better way to wrap up this interview. Ifat, thank you so much for joining us. I hope that everybody heeds your words. And please go check out Madre online and support the amazing work they are doing. Ifat, thank you once more.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. And this has been Code Pink Radio, WBAI 99.5, WPFW 89.3. We're going to take a short break, and when we're back, we will be joined by Daniel Ellsberg, so stay tuned.
No matter how hard they try, they can't hold the waters back like a wave that has gone for the shore. We're inevitable, and when we decide that we're fighting for the lives of the least of us, then we've won. In this land, we have soldiers to righteously defend.
We're back with Code Pink Radio, WBAI 99.5, WPFW 89.3. Thank you for joining us.
So, Rose, we're waiting while we're waiting for Daniel to join this conversation. We were having him join us this morning to talk about a film you and I both saw. It's called Official Secrets. It's a film about another whistleblower, Catherine Gunn, who exposed the lies and bullying of the United States and British government in their drive to wage an illegal, unjust war on Iraq. This film was made by Oscar winner Gavin Hood, and it stars Keira Knightley, Ralph Fiennes, and Matt Smith. Now, you weren't there when I was there. We were actually in Iraq when that Colin Powell speech happened at the UN. And you're watching that film, you know, as a young woman. What did you feel like when you saw that?
Yeah, it was really weird. In one word, I'll say it was really weird because I'm 22, for those of you who couldn't tell by my voice. And I was about 8 years old when we invaded Iraq for the first time. And honestly, I don't remember any of it. It's just something I've learned about in school through my own studies, etc. And watching this movie threw me in it. It made me feel like I was there, like I was in the country when this was happening. And it gave me insight into how people were actually feeling and how angry people were when the US announced its invasion. And, you know, now we know when the UK was covertly assisting the US in bullying other countries into okaying this invasion. And, you know, it's something that so significantly impacts all of our political consciousnesses. It's something that my generation learns about as one of the biggest mistakes. But we were too young to really do anything about it at the time. You know, a lot of us were 7, 8 years old. We just remember seeing horrific pictures on TV and hearing people talk about the war. But what that actually meant was never personal, but this movie helped bridge that gap for me, and it made it more personal, and it helped me empathize with how normal people were feeling during the time.
Well, what did you think about the fact that, you know, one of the things I felt it did so well was to show how corrupt the media was.
Absolutely.
And that, you know, there were people inside of newspapers and the media that knew it was illegal, knew they were lies, but they were squashed by their editor or their publisher. Mm-hmm. An example for me is when we went to Iraq before the invasion, and we would, you know, one of the things we did is we went to an oil refinery and gave our blood and said, you know, no blood for oil. And a lot of media went with us. They did their story, they sent it back to the United States, and it didn't show anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
We met with weapons inspectors that said, no, there are no weapons of mass destruction. And those stories got told by the reporters in Iraq, and they never were shown in the United States. And so to see in this film, the scene inside of the newspaper, the Observer, and see that clearly there were reporters that knew about the lies, and then with Catherine Gunn's memo released, we know about the bullying, and that you still can't get it, the media to cover it.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think about that?
I think it's a testament to how important independent media is and alternative media is, because I grew up watching CNN, MSNBC, and I was thinking that I am on the left because I watch CNN and MSNBC. And as I grew up, I soon learned that wasn't the case. And, you know, we have this illusion of left and right in this country. We say MSNBC is left, Fox News is right. But at the end of the day, the people who own these corporations are the billionaires. And the billionaires are the ones who line their pockets with war, with destruction, with scorching the earth. And it took me, I think, until I got to college to really learn that the corporate media is not on our side. The corporate media serves the elite. They serve the political agenda of the state. And even though we think of these journalists as being accountable to the people, all we have to think about is the New York Times parading the weapons of mass destruction narrative and lying to this entire country and instilling so much fear in us. And that's how they manufacture this consent. That's how they do that amongst the population of this country, of Britain. They make us afraid. They create this enemy and they lie to us and they manipulate us. And I think the most powerful thing that we can do is refuse to be manipulated by the corporate media, to listen to independent media, and more so, like you were saying, to listen to journalists on the ground, to listen to Iraqi journalists, to listen to Iranian journalists, Venezuelan journalists, etc. Because when I was watching this movie, and I would love to get your thoughts on this, it just rings so familiar, because we have what's happening in Iran, we have what's happening in Venezuela, and we have our corporate media parading these false narratives about what's happening. And I guess I'm wondering for you, did you feel that resonance? And how can we take the lessons from Iraq and apply it to today?
So thank you. Yes, that's exactly. I asked Gavin Hood, the director, did he plan this? Because it was so important for this to be laid out in this story right this minute when the lies are happening again. But the sad part is that she did tell the truth and the war went on. Mm. And the one thing that maybe her exposing the lies did stop the UN second approval of the war, which the reason she didn't get prosecuted was that exposing the information that was necessary to prosecute her would mean that Britain was liable for war crimes, mm-hmm. and they didn't want to go there. Remember that part?
Absolutely.
So this goes back to when we were in Iraq right after the invasion, and we could see everything that was going on, the torture, the illegality, the violence. And I came back wanting a whistleblower, because we could tell the stories, but no one would repeat them. The media wouldn't cover them. And so it was just like, okay, we need a whistleblower. So I went around raising money so that we could make Most Dangerous Man in America, the film about Daniel Ellsberg. And this is to talk about the importance of storytelling and culture and what media can do. So when Daniel went to Russia to meet Ed Snowden, Ed grabbed him by his arms, he said, and said to him, "Daniel, when I saw Most Dangerous Man in America, I had the courage to do what I did."
Wow.
So
that gives me chills. That's amazing.
So this is important that we tell these stories and that we reveal these truths. And that's why I think it's so important that people go see Official Secrets to be reminded of the structures that we live inside of the violence of our governments, of their willingness to lie mm-hmm. and basically kill people. Kill people, yes. A million of people.
A million Iraqis are like what higher estimates show were the casualties from the illegal war on lies.
Let's not stop at that. Yeah. I mean, I remember being in Congress we were outside the White House. Code Pink started as a reaction to Bush's using of the color-coded alerts, red, orange, and yellow, to say Code Pink for peace. And we were outside the White House for 6 months almost saying, no war. And one of the things we said is this is an opening of Pandora's box. Mm-hmm. So yes, a million Iraqis have died, but look at Yemen, look at Syria,
absolutely.
Look at the destabilization, and also look at, what Iran has been living under since then.
Yeah.
As soon as the Iraq war started, Medea and I looked at each other and we said, okay, we're going to stop the next war now.
Yeah.
And that has been our focus.
Yeah.
And, so many things come out of that are the work of Code Pink right now. But yes, these lies continue. Yes, the media continues to be drumbeats for war. An example is when Obama was pushing for the bombing of Syria.
Mm-hmm. The red line.
Yes, the red line. And Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, who's, it's always great when you're an activist to have a research arm, which Institute for Policy Studies always has been for Code Pink. And Phyllis Bennis came out with 10 points for diplomacy instead of bombing, which when you took it into Congress was just a novel idea. Oh, really? There's points for diplomacy? Mm-hmm. So as Obama is pulling members of Congress into the White House every 3 hours, we're walking the halls of Congress with her 10 points of diplomacy. And I remember the moment of Congressman Waxman, who had voted for the funding of war, and I'd really kind of shamed him about it. And I said, look, you cannot bomb another country if there are 10 things you should be doing before then. Mm-hmm. And he looked at him, he goes, does the White House know these? And I said, I don't know. He says, well, I'm going there now. I'm going to take them. And he did, and he called me and he said, I showed it to them. They didn't have an answer. I'm not going to vote.
Wow.
And so, I can tell other stories of where they've been ready to bomb Iran or create some blockade of the Persian Gulf, and where we've kind of got in the middle of that story. And it's like Ifat said, it's like, I call it the fear of fretting. Fear of fretting doesn't do us any good. It's the engagement. And, one of the things that we've been saying after our talkbacks at the Official Secrets is one of the things we can do is local. And that is that, really realizing that we're spending over 50% of our tax dollars on war, and that we have to, stop the Pentagon budget. But the way we can work on that right now is in our cities, in our counties, mm-hmm. in our states, in our churches, in our schools. They need to divest from war. That basically they're making a killing on killing. And it's greed.
Absolutely.
So what's happening in New York on that?
So much. So much. And I'm so happy that you brought that up, because that's a testament to local power. A lot of the times we see these big systems and we ask, can we do? And the answer is that we are part of these institutions, and whether we realize it or not, they are aiding and abetting war. They're aiding and abetting killing, and they're helping people, like you said, make a killing on killing. So there's lots happening in New York City that everybody can get plugged into. First, I'm not sure if our listeners have heard of BlackRock, but BlackRock is an institution that is invested in just about every awful weapons manufacturer that you can imagine. They're invested in the private detention centers where migrant children are being held. They're invested in corporations that are actively polluting our earth. And their CEO, Larry Fink, is out here parading himself as a liberal. He's saying that he cares about corporate social responsibility and the like. But what we don't realize is that that's first a lie. And secondly, that BlackRock is so intimately entwined with many institutions that we interact with on a daily basis. Let's take MoMA, for example, the Museum of Modern Art. Amazing place. I've been there before. You know, it's always nice to take a day off and to consume some beautiful art. But what does that mean when Larry Fink is on the board of the Museum of Modern Art, when the Museum of Modern Art is getting its funding in part from a man who is lining his pockets with death and destruction? So something that Code Pink is going to be taking up, likely with a coalition of other organizations, is calling for Larry Fink to be removed from the board. And this is coming on the heels of the successful action of Decolonize This Place, who, with a coalition of partners, got Warren Kanders, CEO of Safariland, off the board of the Whitney Museum of American Art. And for those of you who aren't familiar, Safariland is a horrible corporation that produces the tear gas that is used to poison children in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Puerto Rico, on the southern border, and in our own communities, likely against Black and brown protesters. And this is just part of the movement to decolonize our art spaces, to decolonize our institutions. There are also amazing students at universities across New York City and across the country who are calling on their institutions to divest from war. When I was just in college, we actually passed one of these resolutions through NYU student government. We were calling on them to divest from Lockheed Martin, which produces something called the Fighting Falcon Jet, which is used regularly by countries to indiscriminately bomb civilians, from General Dynamics, from Caterpillar, from Raytheon. And these are all these weapons manufacturers that our universities are invested in, our institutions of higher education are funding their activities with the profits of war. And when there is a war, don't make any mistake, these companies become more profitable. The more people that their products kill, the more profitable they are as corporations. And we just have to take a moment to take in how obscene, perverse, and disgusting that is, that we people are making money on exhibiting that their weaponry has the capacity to cause mass death and destruction.
Well, if our listeners want to engage with you and NYU or in MoMA, how would they reach you?
So there are so many ways. First of all, for any listener, I give you my email, and I want you all to send me an email if you want to get involved with any New York City activities. It's going to be rose, like the flower, rose@codepink.org, rose@codepink.org. Shoot me an email, follow us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and we will get you plugged in with some of the amazing efforts that are happening across the city. For instance, today, like I said in the opening segment, I'm going to be heading to a city council hearing because we are calling on New York City with the abolitionist group No New Jails to reject Mayor Bill de Blasio's plan to build 4 new jails using $10 billion of taxpayer money. And what this just brings to mind, and it's something that you touched on when you said that half of our tax dollars go to war, and you know it goes to services, quote-unquote services, that we never see, is that we have the money to build a country that works for everybody. We have the money in our country to give everybody health care, to give everybody a quality education, including college, to give everybody a home, to give everybody water and food. We have the money, it's there. People call these utopian ideas, but it's not. And I think it comes down to a question of the war economy and the peace economy and how we sustain each of those. And you've spoken about this on a show before, but I think it fits so prominently into this conversation we're having now. So I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit
about
that.
And it goes to what Ifat said earlier, is that we know the path to peace. She's building the path to peace. But is the money going to that, or is the money going to death and destruction? And that's what we're seeing, that the money's going to death and destruction. And it really, it's up to each one of us. We can look at it and see that the system is broken, But the only thing we can do is like leave that system, find ways to divest ourselves from the war economy and invest ourselves in the peace economy, the giving, sharing, caring, thriving, relational, resilient economy without which none of us would be alive. It's up to each one of us. And I know that there's something this week to get involved on the Amazon. You were talking about BlackRock, and BlackRock's one of the big investors in the devastation that's happening in the Amazon fires right now. What's happening this week on the 5th?
It's actually the 13th. There's going to be an action at the, I think it's in front of the United Nations. There's an event happening called Bolsonaro Time is Up. And that's going to be Friday, September 13th, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at 225 East 41st Street. And you can join this coalition of climate activists to say Bolsonaro's government will either have or have not given a public response by this date. And either way, we deserve a response by his government that has led to much of this destruction that we have seen. And just generally, there are a few other things that you can do to get involved this week. I think that we're going to be getting Daniel on the line in a moment, just to give us some closing words before we sign off. But I just want to let you all know that this Friday, you can join Code Pink and the DSA Anti-War Working Group at an action at Representative Nydia Velasquez's office. We're calling on her to co-sponsor the Promoting Human Rights for Palestinian Children Living Under a Military Occupation Act, also known as H.R. 2407. This bill would prohibit U.S. taxpayer funding for the military detention of children in any country, including Israel. You can also join Decolonize This Place this Saturday at the Teresa Lang Student Center, 55th West 13th Street at 11:30 a.m. to talk about next steps in the MoMA Whitney campaign. And I think we have Daniel Ellsberg on the line. Daniel, are you there?
I'm here, and I'm sorry I had this down for tomorrow. I apologize.
Well, Daniel, we talked about official secrets, and is there anything quick you want to say to the audience about Catherine Gunn and official secrets?
Well, I think the quote that I gave right at the very beginning of when she was first identified was that this was the most courageous leak or revelation, whistleblowing, that I'd ever seen in terms of timeliness in particular. She put her life on the line at the very right time before a war was started. I know of no one else, including me, who has done that, who has acted fast enough and courageously enough in time possibly to avert a war. She had strong reason to believe, by the way, stronger than the movie makes clear, I think, that she would avert it because Prime Minister Blair had committed himself that he would not go to an aggressive war in the absence of a second vote from the UN. And in fact, of course, he did do that to stay in lockstep with the U.S. in its crime against the people. In fact, she did prevent a second vote because she revealed to a number of states like Chile and Mexico who had suffered CIA machinations in the past that the NSA now was about to manipulate them into a vote supporting the war, and their people could not abide that. So she did prevent a second vote and made it very clear at the time and for history that the U.S. and U.K. and a number of other nations were committing a war of aggression.
Daniel, thank you so much for jumping on at the end of our show. We're encouraging everyone to see Official Secrets. We love you. Thank you for being our hero and a whistleblower.
Thank you, Daniel.
Sorry. Bye.
Of course. We'll have you on another time.
And okay, fine. I apologize.
Of course. And again, this is Code Pink Radio on WBAI 99.5 FM, New York City, WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for joining us. Again, please email me. I'd love to hear from you, and I'd love to get you all involved with New York City activism. And if you're in D.C., we'll plug you in there too. rose@codepink.org. Rose like the flower at codepink.org. Thank you all. Thank you again, Jody, for joining us. And peace.
Peace.
It's blood for oil. We know there's a link. They say code war.
We say code pink.
It's blood for oil. We know there's a link.
Go pink! was not Iraq, but Iran.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think.
They say code terror,
we say code pink.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think. They say code terror,
we say code pink.
Code pink for freedom, code pink for peace, code pink to hunger.
WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.